Hi, and welcome to the Making Our Way podcast. This week, our guest is Josh Fick of Fick Tool and Design, and he tells us all about his miniatures of classic tools. Thanks for listening. Hey guys, what's happening?
What's up, man? Good to see you.
Yeah, you too. What you been up to, Austin?
Man, I've just been, doing my video thing, and I'm sick.
Wait, you're making videos?
Yeah, I make videos.
Are they on Instagram?
Yeah, you can't see them. Sorry.
Okay. And you've been sick. Imagine that.
Yeah, I'm sick. Yeah. I mean, hey.
I'm telling you, your house is on an Indian burial ground.
Something's up.
Pet cemetery, something.
Dude, I need some, burn some sage up in here. But I've been doing videos like crazy, and I've been starting to move my shop around, doing a little reorganize and I moved my milling machines closer together, and just, you know, kind of seeing what I like and all that kind of stuff.
You know, it's funny you said you've been doing videos, and now that you say that, when we first started recording, like, you looked, you know, early 30s maybe. And then I guess you did something in the settings and you look more accustomed to what I'm seeing now. So yeah. You haven't been doing any video trickeration, have you?
Oh, I've just been, I stay with the filter on all the time now.
So do those wrinkle cream filters, do those help with like bad welds and stuff too?
I wish, yeah. That's what I need.
That's the filter we need to invent. It's how to make your shitty crafts look okay.
Yeah, it's been a little bit, like when you're filming two a day, and I'm posting two a day. I'm filming way more than two a day, and I'm like, man, I'm racing through all of my video.
And
so today,
2 days a lot, yeah.
Well, yeah, and sometimes it's like I'm shooting. There's like a bunch of shots for each video. Like, you know, it's a process. So process videos take way longer than me just stopping and talking about something, and so I'm shooting all day long. And then this afternoon I was like, man, I am like toast on ideas here. And so I just popped in the clubhouse and I was like, yo, everybody ask me a question that you have about machining. And I just wrote, I'm not answering any of you guys. You'll see it in videos coming up. And so I just jotted down a whole list of videos. And I think a bunch of those ideas were great. And it's funny because most of all of those guys are woodworkers or other media, you know, other crafts. And so their questions were great from like people who
That's
were
a great
new,
idea.
Newbies or whatever. And I was like, man, that was a good little, because they're asking specifics about like the bore spindle size hole, like the spindles in the headstocks, like how much material, how thick of a material can you pass through, and questions like that. And I'm like, oh, that's great. Yeah, I would have never thought to make that, you know, because I just assume everybody knows that. But obviously, it's definitely not a known thing unless you were researching all the different lathes and things like that. So, but yeah, I'm staying busy, and it's 2 days moving. I don't know how Chris does three a day. Like that is
well, it's because he's posting one video in three parts.
I should just split it up more. Like that's part one. Catch part two in 3 hours.
There's a lot of those out there.
Christy, what have you been up to this week?
Well, I made some progress. I don't know that I mentioned it on here. I think I did on Patreon, where I've been working on a leather journal cover for Anna. And so,
that looks nice.
Yeah. So I'm a big journal person, write in all kinds of my activities, daily stuff, tracking things. Anna is more of a book reader and she likes to jot down stuff about that. She's really into journaling as well. So her idea was to use a small three ring binder style. So I'm making her a leather cover for, it's actually like a six ring because it's like 9x6 or something like that. But anyway, so I got, the leather. I printed out a picture of books stacked up that when she was here for Christmas, we kind of did some planning, and I carved that on a piece of leather, veg tan leather, and did a little dyeing the different books, different color. And then I made that as a patch rather than putting it directly on the leather cover, because obviously in case I make a mistake.
Yeah, we know your cheats. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I only have enough of this thickness leather for the two journals, hers and mine. And actually the inside piece of leather is a thinner type just because I didn't have enough to make both all the parts for both journals out of this thickness veg tan.
Let me ask you something, because you made that from two pieces. Did you, mm-hmm. when you put the glued or laminated or whatever you call it, those two pieces together, did you glue it in the final curve shape, or did you glue it flat?
Well, I have not done the outside yet. This is still, I haven't attached both pieces of leather to the binder.
Yeah.
So the inside, it was just flat because there's no, it's inside.
Right.
But I think that's kind of why I've been dragging my feet a little bit, because I'm a little worried about the folding it together versus laying flat, because I'm gluing it directly on the relatively thin plastic cover that is on this journal. But this leather is like, I think it's like five.
Do you have that? Can you hold it up? Do you have the journal?
Yeah, here's the journal. It's just a plastic.
Oh, okay. So it has rings, right?
Yes, it's got the rings on the inside. This is mine.
You know what I would actually do, Christy? And this is just me. Well, first, I think you're going to need to scuff the plastic so that you get a good.
That's a good point. Yes, that's a good idea.
I think we had talked about possibly drilling out those rivets and putting rivets all the way through.
Yeah, we had talked about that.
But you chickened out.
I did on this first one with Anna's. Okay. Yes, I did.
So if you hadn't chickened out, the rivets and just those would be great. But what I would do is I would glue just the spine and then let that dry. And then I would glue the other ones on, because that way you've got the foundation there and then you can fold those independent of each other. If you don't do that, the way I recommend is don't glue it folded, glue it at 90, like at a 45 or 90. So one leg hang off the table and glue it. So that way you're kind of in the middle of both open and closed. Because if you glue it closed, when you try to open it, it's going to bind. If you glue it open, when you close it, it's going to pull. So if you go in the middle, you kind of get the best give of both worlds. But in that scenario, I would either glue the spine first or leave some gap on the spine. Yeah, leave a gap on the spine. And then you've got the full, let the spine take all the motion.
Yeah, when they're doing like bookbinding, they don't glue the spine. There's air. If you look at a normal book folded backwards, there's air gap all the way through. And that's for that reason. So it can move.
Yeah. Don't. Yeah.
Okay.
Give a gap. Well, spine. But I think if on something that thin, I really do think if you drilled out those two rivets and just put two copper rivets or whatever through that rivet and the one on the bottom, that what's holding the rings to that piece of plastic.
Right. So you're saying, because I can still do this on the other one, because this is my Anna's. All I have is the leather attached to the inside, so I can still go ahead and take the rivets out.
Yeah.
So you're saying take the rivets out.
Are you doing like pockets where the plastic's okay?
No, I'm sticking it straight.
Yeah, I would just drill the rivets out. It's super easy. Just
drill the rivets out.
Yeah. And then take a copper rivet that I'm sure you and Marvin got a thousand.
We've got
of
all
them,
kinds. Yeah.
And you just run a rivet back through that same hole.
But you're saying the spine part.
Well, there's two stories here. If if you're going to rivet it to it, now it's connected. It ain't going anywhere. It doesn't matter what it wants to do. But if you want to glue it, then we're saying leave that gap and just glue it to the two sides and then glue it at kind of a 45, a 90, I guess I'm trying to say, so that you're kind of in between the fold, the open and the close.
Okay. If it was me and I was riveting it, I would be really tempted to get rid of that plastic.
Mm-hmm.
Like just rivet the.
You guys
just rivet the rings.
Plastic last time.
I don't think the glue is going to stick to the plastic.
Have you done contact cement?
Contact cement would melt the. Okay, that would melt the plastic.
It was barge glue. Barge glue is what I've done before.
Yeah. Barge probably.
It's out in the or barge cement or whatever it is. Yeah. It's out in the shop. I think it will.
I like how we go for constructive. Like, I'm like, you've already started.
Since you're basically done.
but see, I've only attached the insides to the plastic, the inside leather piece to the plastic.
Kind of anything. It's your girls. And if they break, you have a gift to give them 3 years from now or whatever. Yeah.
I would.
You can cut it up and make a purse out of it. And just
rivet it for yours. Okay. I would totally do that.
So take the plastic off and just use the plastic, the leather. Just rivet it.
That's okay. Rivet
the rings to the leather.
I'm going
to
go back and listen to our previous conversation because I think
we didn't have visual aids, you know?
Right.
It's now true. We have visual aids.
Okay.
Like all the listeners.
All right. We shall see. Now I'm really curious after we're done recording tonight. I got to go out there to shop and see if my if it's actually sticking to the plastic or not, because I didn't think about scuffing it up or anything. So,
I mean, barge cement.
Barge is toxic as shit. It's definitely
going to melt the plastic a little bit. But, no doubt. But okay. Any slick surface, glue will dry to that shape. And so you have two slick surfaces butted up against each other. Nothing's grabbing hold.
Gotcha.
But if it melted the plastic, you'll be okay.
All right. Well, I'm going to check as soon as we're done recording tonight. All right. So, Dean, what have you been up to?
Unlike Austin, I've had like 1,000 opportunities for video content. But I've not posted anything.
And right.
It's been kind of weird. So I'm in week 2 of this no Instagram experiment. And yes, Keith, I know I just messaged you on Instagram. It's because on Thursdays, I open Instagram to research the guest. And I have it open when we're recording. And I saw Keith did a brass tag. It looked really good. So I commented how good it looked. But so we had weather come through on Tuesday. I mean, I'm sure everybody had something similar. And I come home from work and the oak tree in our front yard, it's a giant oak tree, and a limb about 20 feet long had snapped, but was hanging from the tree straight down into the street. I go and I look and it's right on the property line. I'm like, I know some asshole on their phone is going to drive by, not pay attention, hit this tree limb and sue the shit out of me. And so I was like, it's got to come down. So Kristen came home, got her in the Land Cruiser, did some country shit, tied a tow strap to it and just told her drive, you know, it's heavy ass truck, four wheel drive, you drive this way. And so we pulled the limb, like continued to brake, went in that same direction and pulled it down, landed in the middle of the road, rehooked my loop, got her to drive through the yard, drug it into the yard, and then left it there that night. And then Wednesday I came home from work. Well, that was Monday. Then Tuesday I came home from work, got the chainsaw out, cut it up, got a bunch of firewood, some wood I might actually try to make some stuff out of. Maybe by next Christmas it'll be dry enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then piled up all the limbs and stuff by the street. But I mean, like, that was a lot of good video opportunity, pulling a tree limb down with the truck and pulling it through the yard and then using the chainsaw the next day and all this good stuff. And then on Wednesday, poor Madeline's got a tooth infection, so I had to take her to the vet. So work will let you go like to the doctor and stuff, like that's no big deal, but the expectation is you're still working, you know, phone calls, emails. And I was like, you know what, I'm not working, I'm taking PTO the rest of the day. And so I took the afternoon off, took her to the vet, came home, I'm trying to watch The Martian with Matt Damon, and a guy knocks on the door. It's it was one of these guys that just drives around looking for odd jobs. And he saw the tree limbs from Wednesday. And he's like, hey, I'll take those, pick those up, take them to the dump for you. And I said, no, man, the city does that. I'm not paying somebody to do that. And then he looks and he goes, well, I'll cut that tree down, make you a good deal. And so Kristen's been bitching about this magnolia tree that this heat this summer killed. She's hated it for years, but specifically since the summer killed it with all the heat, and it's dead. But I didn't want to believe it was dead. I always have hope. I'm a positive person. I believed it was going to come back to life. And but anyway, just doing all that other lumberjack stuff, I said, you know what? How much? And he gave me a price. I thought it was fair. And I was like, so when are you going to do this? He's like, right now. I go,
right now.
He's like, no, just me. I'm going to climb up there and start cutting. And I was like, fuck it. All right, go ahead. So I went inside and started watching the movie again. So I text Kristen and I said, hey, this guy's outside cutting the tree down. And she's like, did you get a copy of his insurance? I said, Kristen, it's a man who's driving down the street offering to do odd jobs. He doesn't have insurance, which I do not recommend to anyone. But the tree's close to the street. It's not by the house. Wasn't going to fall anything. He might have got hurt, but I'd have just drug his ass out into the street if he got hurt. He did a great job. And I even went out there and was like, you know, hey, these parts here, can you cut in these dimensions? And I took a piece of chalk and he's like, yeah, just mark how you want it cut. And he cut. So I have tons of wood from this tree now that I bought some of that edge sealing stuff. Came in today. I'm going to anchor seal them all tomorrow. And then hopefully by, you know, next year when I'm getting ready for holidays, I'll have a lot of material to make some bowls and stuff out of or whatever.
Oh, cool.
But
did he have his own tools or did you?
Oh, this dude was a machine. So this dude, all right, he had a Toyota Tacoma, one ton. So it was like the low body, old school Tacoma, one ton. And I knew something was off because the front wheels looked kind of heavy duty. And then I looked closer and it had a dually axle in the back. And he had put it, he said, he bought it in California. It was a flatbed and he put a cage on it and he had a lift gate, a cage, and the toolbox on both sides of the wheel well. It was a neat little truck. And he had like some big side view mirrors he took off a Dodge, you know, three-quarter ton or something. But this was a one-ton Tacoma. And it was already half full of shit that he had picked up driving around the neighborhood. And I'm like, you're going to fit. This tree's 35, 40 feet tall. And I said, you're going to fit all this in that truck. He said, oh, yeah, no problem. If not, I'll come back tomorrow. And I'm like, well, you ain't getting all the money until all the tree's gone, just so we're clear. And what he would do is he would load the truck up and then he'd get put the long bar on his chainsaw. And it was the sketchiest shit I'd ever seen. He stood on top of it and just cut down and just kept moving his chainsaw around between his feet as and we just kept cutting and packing. And he fit that whole tree in the back of that truck.
Dang.
So I went out there with my little push broom like my grandma used to do. And I'm sweeping the driveway before Kristen gets home from work. And he went and grabbed a rake and he's cleaned up and he said, all good. I said, yeah. So while he was doing that, I'm working on the Land Cruiser. We have an older Land Cruiser, an 85, and I'm changing the carburetor. I'm struggling to reach this bolt. And he comes over. Hey, I replaced windshields too. You want me to do the windshield? So the guy who cut our magnolia tree down sourced a windshield and he wants to replace the windshield on Land Cruiser. But I told him I got to get it running before we spend any money on it. But it's
that's too funny.
It's been interesting. That and I've got a little table project I'm working on and a few other little small things, but yeah, all kind
of
stuff.
Snap a picture of his truck.
I've got it on my Ring. I'll send you a picture of it.
Yeah, I want to see it.
Yeah, it's not a super close photo, but I got it on the Ring.
I'm just curious. I've never seen a one ton.
Yeah, it was wild, man.
That's cool. I mean, I think every Toyota in the other parts of the world they're considered one tons because they put everything in them. Like,
yeah.
50. Well, that was the other
thing. Like, I'm looking at the tires on this thing. I'm like, how the hell is this going to, like, even though you can fit it, doesn't mean that it can handle.
It can carry like, it.
When we used to do roll off boxes, we would only fill them 3/4 of the way because over 20,000 pounds, it was a DOT road. Like the road can't handle that weight. Right. And so it was just interesting watching him load this truck. It was really cool. Well, look, before we end Q1, if it's okay with you guys, I had told our friend Jacob from Maker Cuisine. He's a part of the maker scene in New Orleans, and everybody knows I love Louisiana, but they've got a little shop there, Nola Works LLC, and it's the makerspace that he's a part of, and they're in the process of transitioning into a nonprofit. So they're doing a little GoFundMe to try to raise the money to facilitate that switch over to the nonprofit. You can find them at Nola Works LLC or go to Jacob's Maker Cuisine Instagram, and he's got it posted. But in addition, this comes out on Tuesday. On the Friday, the 19th, they're going to have a silent auction. So if you're in the New Orleans area and you're looking for something makery to do, that might be something cool to check out. It says they'll have a silent auction, food, drinks, demonstration, music, and more. And maybe you'll find a makerspace that can serve some of your purchases if you're in that New Orleans metro area. So go check out that link. And if you can support them, that'd be great. And I just wanted to tell Jacob, thanks for everything he's done for us and the maker community.
Yeah.
And we hope that we can help him with this.
We'd like to take a minute and thank the folks over at Patreon for their financial support. On our top tier, we've got Marion Ward from Creative Ward Gallery, Scott Oren from Daddy Yourself, Ozark Spirit, Chris Shelby, and Nick Birchtold. Tonight, we're joined with Josh Fick. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you make.
I am an engineer and a dad of two boys, and I make big things little. I make miniatures.
Like very Honey, good. Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah.
Honey,
I shrunk the tools.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of helping with the handout of the tools, toys, the maker swap items at Makers Camp. And let me tell you what, your item was quite something to behold, and it had everybody's attention. So can you kind of describe what you brought to Makers Camp?
Yeah, so I brought approximately a 1/12 scale Bridgeport milling machine, a series one with a, I think, a J2 head on it, if I remember my specs correctly. And it was as functional as it could be. And it even had a working original light on it.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. To be honest with you, I found the LEDs first and had to figure out something to model that needed a light so that I could use it.
Yeah, that's funny.
How long have you been kind of making these type of miniatures?
So I've been making these type of miniatures for probably about 3 years now. I kind of started strangely, and this is a little bit of a bone of contention between Chris Cash and Andrew Alexander. Chris Cash delivered a Canton Foundry shop crane to Jimmy DiResta, but I believe Andrew gifted it to him. So Andrew bought it, but Chris delivered it. And I screwed up saying that line of events at Maker Camp 1 year, and Chris quickly corrected me. but I saw it and I was like, man, I really like that shape. It's a crazy looking profile. And I was like, I wonder if I can model it. I had been modeling some things for my job, and it's like, it's a really cool shape. I wonder if I could do that. So it took me a while, but I was able to kind of put it together and then posted a couple pictures of it, and it took off like wildfire. I've sold probably more of those little Canton cranes than I have any of my other models.
Cool. Oh, wow. So why did you choose what you chose? Why did you choose the Bridgeport for Maker's Camp? I'm curious.
Well, last year I did a little giant power hand.
Oh,
So that was kind of tailored towards the bladesmiths a little bit. But this year I wanted to do something in the metalworking world, but maybe something that was a little bit broader. My biggest fear is that like a fine woodworker would end up with one of mine and be like, what is this?
Yeah,
I only know what any of those things are because of Austin. So, you know, from a woodworker's perspective, at least I've got metalworking friends so they can educate me a little bit on that. So can you start taking us through the process of, you said when you were modeling it, what software are you using, or what's your like techniques at the very beginning of that process?
So to answer your first question, the software that I use is AutoCAD, which is really old school compared to a lot of people. A lot of people for modeling use SolidWorks. Inventor has kind of fallen off a little bit. SolidWorks has kind of taken in engineering industry, kind of taken hold big time. But I've had years of traditional experience with AutoCAD through, you know, high school, college, and then my job. So it's just where I feel comfortable. And they've kind of really come a long way with their modeling aspects of it. So it starts out as a 2D drawing, and then everything gets extruded and that sort of thing. So it's easy for me to jump back and forth. My process starts with once I identify what I want to model, then it's off to the races to the internet. My biggest advantage to finding pictures are auction guides, because generally they take lots of good pictures and from numerous angles. I do have an ace in the hole when it comes to Andrew Alexander, because he's got one of everything at the very least. So I can just say, hey, what's this part look like? And I just message him, and he'll text me right back like, oh, you mean this? Yeah, thanks. Because there's always going to be one angle that I can't figure out, or it's a part that commonly breaks on some of these older equipment. So it's I want to kind of bring it back to its original OEM look. So sometimes it's hard to figure out how it was configured from the factory. So then I find a lot of pictures and I just dump them in a folder. And I'll go to Bing, I'll go to Google, I'll go to DuckDuckGo, and because you'll get different results depending on which one you use. I also use vintagemachinery.org. It is a fantastic resource for old manuals, a lot of the drawings in the manuals, even if it's just for a foundation or it's views, like this is how you set it up, but it's, they're all 2D and they were all drawn to scale back then when they were hand drawn. So it at least it helps me get my proportions right.
Cool.
Yeah, because that's what I was kind of wondering about as far as like, yeah, getting the right proportions and the right sizes and all of that kind of stuff that, you know, that just kind of is beyond me. So are there any like special tricks or tips for somebody that might want to break something apart like this to model out?
Yeah, some of the tips I would say is if you can find the most perpendicular photos you can. And if you're starting out on something and you don't have something picked out, but you find pictures of something, you can get a front, a side, and maybe a back view. I mean, a top would be fantastic, but that's, you know, most of the stuff I model is tall, so that's kind of rare.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of worked from there. I start out in large 2D shapes and then kind of whittle it away from there. Because I come from a machinist background, a lot of times I forget that I can add on to. So I'll work in reduction sometimes. And then I have to remind myself, I'm not constrained to like cutting something out of a shape. I can just, if I need to add something, I can just extrude it off one side or add to it or combine objects. So I try to work in the front view, side view as much as I can. And then I start kind of building that out.
Do you ever like take like personal liberties with details? Like you're like, well, I think it should have actually had this there, or this extra piece would have looked better this direction or functioned differently. Or are you strictly by the book, strictly by the pictures? This is how it was.
I try to keep it pretty true. I do take a lot of liberties with fasteners. Sometimes flat. I mean, a lot of the older materials, older machines, they're all flathead screws and they're boring. So sometimes I like to add hex bolts, you know, and if it was a bolt rather than a stud, it makes sense for a stud and a nut to be there. I'll add that. I try to stick pretty close to the original, but I always think back to something that I saw Adam Savage when he had his book tour, and he said, when recreating something, and he's highly detailed and super finite with being exact, there's a certain point where something stops being accurate and starts being right. So sometimes it might be right. For instance, like if the Bridgeport table is supposed to be 42 inches wide, if you scale that down, sometimes it doesn't look right. It looks like the table's too wide for the base. So there's certain things that to the eye don't look quote unquote correct. So there's a point in which I get it as accurate as I can. And I'm like, I don't like the way that looks.
That makes
sense.
Then you design these models. How are you developing, like, how are you building them out? I'm assuming 3D printing.
Yeah. So I best describe them as like multimedia sculptures kind of. So I'll use stereolithography printing or resin printing. That's kind of been like my newer side of stuff. I had originally built a Bridgeport before, but it was kind of, for lack of a better term, a low poly. So it was Bridgeport shaped, but compared to the new one, they're night and day. But the resin printing and how far that's come gives me the ability to put such finite detail that it really punches up the models.
So you're a big fan of resin versus the filament printers?
I split it between the two. So for instance, we could talk about the Bridgeport, the base casting of the Bridgeport, the knee, and the, what I would call like the knuckle. So where the ram bolts to the main casting, those were all, FDM printed. So filament printed. If it's a not complicated shape, doesn't have a lot of fine detail, FDM is the way to go. I get great results, but low cost of entry and, you know, not a lot of sticky resin or, because resin, unfortunately, with the larger stuff, and this may be my novice with resin, it tends to sag and it tends to warp the larger you go. So sometimes I have to break parts out into smaller components, because if I get too long with them, then it tends to kind of droop as it prints, because it's still in a soft state until you finally cure it.
Sure. So FDM for ease, resin for detail.
Correct. Correct.
What about on the horizon? Are there any materials that you would like to maybe venture into?
Oh, yes. I so badly want to start making metal models, like fully functional in the way of they have screws, they move, they function the way the real thing does.
Well, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll get there, and that's going to be a huge jump.
Yeah. I really would like to go the way of investment casting, just because that seems to be the best bang for your buck. I mean, you could start out with billets and whittle away and get exactly what you want, but the ability to investment cast it and get it 80% there, and then just machine the important stuff, tap the holes, that kind of thing. Hamler Tools on Instagram. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with him. He makes amazing miniatures of firearms, miniature tools. He's done the turtle shell carpenter's vise, big 6-inch vise, and they're fully functional, all the screws.
Wow.
I think one of the craziest ones. Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
He did a Monarch EE tool room lathe.
Wow.
Fully functional. The dials for the speed work, the chucks, like it's a 3-jaw chuck. He machined the eccentric in there to make the jaws move in it. I mean, it's unreal. So when I grow up, I want to be Hamler Tools.
I love it. When you're modeling these tools, about how many would you say you go through on average from, hey, here's my first crack at it, to here's something I'm comfortable selling?
I would say it probably goes through very least 3 iterations, if not more. There's a main phase where, you know, I do a lot of modeling. Then there's a lot of test printing. So I print everything out exactly how I have it sized and modeled. Now that I've had experience with doing a few different models, I know roughly in the scale that I'm working in, I want this hole to work for a 440 screw. So I kind of know what size they need to be, what kind of clearances I need to get things to fit together nicely, but you don't have to sand every one of them. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
But then it moves into a test print phase. So I'm printing parts, seeing if they fit together. Oh, I got to bump this out so much. I got to, you know, tighten this hole up a little bit. So there's kind of ease of manufacturing. So it's easy for me to put together on the back end. The less I have to hand fit, better, if I have like multiple orders or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to talk a little bit deeper about the Bridgeport. And as you're building it, you know, what are you building it from the ground up, just like one piece at a time, putting it together? Or is it kind of make all the parts and then make, you know, figure out how they fit together?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a combination of both. So I'll start out with like the main shape, kind of block it all together. And then there's a point where I kind of work backwards. So kind of divvying it up for the printer, what it would allow it to print well. For instance, the saddle of the Bridgeport, the saddle itself is a separate piece from the table. Obviously, in the real world, there are separate pieces as well. But I put a keyway on one side, and I print a male key boss in the opposite side, so that once they're printed out, I can just literally glue them together. I know that the table's clocked correctly with the saddle. I don't have to worry about lining it up perfectly before the glue sets, that sort of thing. But I modeled those two pieces together. Then when I'm kind of getting ready to do those iterations and do the test prints, I'll separate those. And sometimes like the key, I make the keyway too tight. So I have to, you know, in the modeling world, you know, tenths of a thousandth will fit perfectly. But, you know, when you print it out, sometimes, you know, well, this ends up a little big, or the keyway ends up a little bit tight. So kind of got to adjust from there.
Yeah. I was wondering what kind of tolerances you're running. Cause I was actually, I've been doing a bunch of 3D printing, and I was micing everything as it came out. And I was surprised that the bamboo was holding like one thou pretty much on everything. And I was curious if you noticed a difference in tolerance between the resin print versus the FDM printer.
Yeah. So I did a vice cart. It's a New Britain Britain tool company vice cart. I actually found one for Andrew Alexander. He kind of put a hit list out for it, and I actually found one locally to me. So I had the actual one in my possession. It was very hard for me to put it in a box and ship it to Texas, unfortunately. But I actually, the screw mechanism for the vise on the vise cart, the miniature actually functions, but it's 440. So I printed out a test block, and I printed 440 exactly on size, and then went up 10% each time. I think like plus 30% was where it actually, I still had to run a tap through it just to clean it out, but it was actually, I wasn't having to cut threads in there. It was correct to size. The resin, depending on what kind of feature you're doing, it can get trapped because it's a liquid. It can kind of have that like bubble effect where it kind of sticks on the inside of something. And if you don't clean it properly, then you're, you know, drill reaming holes out and that sort of thing. And it has to do with your orientation too. It, the tolerances are tight, but it's like side effects of the resin that kind of end up tripping you up.
Right. Yeah. I was curious with, you know, cause they're all going through some kind of thermocycle, right? So I was curious if they moved during that cycle, you know, and bit you at the end where you're like, oh, this should fit perfect. And then
not so much. I will tell you the elephant foot effect. So when you're squishing down into the build plate on an FDM printer, you will have the same kind of effect with the burn in on a resin printer. That has got me. I've printed, like, thinking I have everything figured out, I've printed batches of like 30 of the same part, and then get them all out and realize that it fits almost all the way through. And then that last like couple thou tightens up, and I'm sitting there with a file like filing out. And of course I could have just printed them again. I don't know why I did, but that part of me was like, no, I'm going to make these ones work.
Yeah. Well, you go through enough suffering, and then next time you'll know, don't do that again.
Yeah. Like, I'm not doing this again.
Yeah. So one of the other questions I had was about the Bridgeport specifically. Mm-hmm. Bridgeports have like thousands of parts. it seems like when I took it, my milling machine apart, I was like, this is so many, like it was daunting when I had it out on the table.
Oh, I can imagine.
And, how did you keep track of all the parts and model? I mean, how many parts did you model like individually for the,
individually, there's probably 50 or 60 parts
wow,
that make it up. But then, you know, in that test print phase, some of the stuff, it doesn't necessarily have to function. They just have to look like they function together. So sure. I kind of combine some parts. So like the quill downfeed mechanism and levers, those are all combined. I may model them separately in the modeling world, and then I'll put them together. I print them. But I actually print it, like if I pull up the CAD file right now, there is a fully built Bridgeport in the CAD space. And then off to the side, I might explode a couple different pieces so that I can kind of see how they go together.
So how did you get so many pictures? Cause you said it was a J head specifically. Mm-hmm. How did you get so many pictures of just like when you Google Bridgeport, you're not going to pull up just J heads, you know, it's going to be every, you know, every model that, I mean, hundreds of models over the years.
So I found a lot of, because the Bridgeport is so popular, luckily there's tons of information out there. I actually found rebuild guides, both produced by Bridgeport and by third parties. And it allowed me to kind of go through and see the parts and how they go together. Especially the head. The head probably took me the longest for sure, just because all the small levers and you know, this plate bolts to this plate and there's screw bosses and that sort of thing. I would say probably 60% of my time is spent just on the head itself.
Wow. I believe, I mean, that's where 60% of your time is in rebuild also.
So I can imagine. So yeah. Going through the manual, seeing how it's tore down and all the small worm gears and everything in there, I'm like, man, it would definitely be a daunting task to do for sure.
Yeah. So speaking of time, how much time do you think you have just in the CAD of drawing a bridge board?
I would say there's probably right around 100 hours of actual time in AutoCAD drawing.
You must be phenomenal at CAD, because it would take me 5 or 6 years.
I luckily do it as a profession as well. So there's been numerous lunch breaks that have been spent switching screens. Okay, I gotta get this far on it today.
Right, right. How many of the guys that work with you are like, I want one of those? I mean, they got to, right? Although
they do. Some of them kind of think they're like, oh yeah, that's like, you know, that's a tchotchke, that's a knickknack. Because I have some of them on a shelf in my office, and they'll come in, they're like, do you make those? And I was like, yeah. Because I also have like a 24-inch Cincinnati shaper. So that gets all the old guys. They're like,
right.
You know what a shaper is? Like, yeah, I know what a shaper is.
Right.
Because they've been phased out. Other than Adam Booth, for the most part, shapers have been phased out in most shops. Although I'm not sure why, because they can definitely hog some material. And there's certain things you can do on a shaper that you can't do on anything else.
Yeah, yeah. If they have them, normally they just have one where they used to have lines and lines of them.
Yeah, they got one over in the corner that's used for a workbench most of the time, but that one job every year that they get.
Yeah, there's probably only one guy in the shop that knows how to use it.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, that's really cool. And so you're talking about, you know, transitioning and making it, you want to go to some metal ones. Mm. Right now, how many of the parts move, or if it do any of the parts on yours move?
Like the bridge port, all the dovetails dovetail. The only thing I didn't do on this model that I did on the low poly bridge port is the table doesn't move left to right. But the dovetail for the saddle moving in and out, the dovetail for the knee moving up and down, they actually fit together and you can move them.
That's cool. Yeah, I was wondering if there was a way that you could model in for an actual lead screw for a functional, you know, like using a 440 or using a piece of all thread.
I have 440 all thread. I used it for some of my projects, and that was definitely a plan at one point. I'll be honest, for Maker Camp, I ran out of time.
Right.
Like, I could spend years on this bridge port, like perfecting it. But I was like, there's a point where I'm like, okay, I have to stop and finish.
No doubt. That's cool, man. It's your final present. I didn't make it to Maker Camp, but when I saw your final presented piece, I'm like, man, that is so, like, to me, it was top two. I wanted somebody made a walnut machinist box. Keith Drennan made a walnut machinist box.
Yes.
And then your model, I was like, man, those are the two that I would have wanted if I went there. So
yeah, there was, it was definitely exciting to kind of hear, you know, cause I don't have a lot of pictures of myself on my Instagram profile, but to be standing, you know, waiting in line, you know, to get something to eat or something, and people like, do you see the bridge port? And like, you know, that gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling. And like,
yeah, okay, what a cool feeling.
I think it's cool, but other people think it's cool too.
And that was great, getting your picture taken with your bridge port by Mark Adams. And I never think about that kind of stuff, but the few times where folks bring their item or have something that's, you know, really their quintessential piece or something like that, to have Mark take a picture with it, I mean, it's just, that's just a great, like, extra for the weekend, it seems like.
Yeah, it was pretty cool too. You know, of course, we were all dodging raindrops.
Yeah.
And I was under the pavilion. I was waiting for the MakerSwap entry to open up. So I had it with me, and Mark was kind of getting set up, and I happened to walk around the corner. He's like, you ready? Do you want to take pictures? Okay, all right, get one of these Apple boxes. Like, he was all excited. Like, I was,
oh yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, awesome. This is awesome. Cause last year, was my first time. So I had the little giant. And he's like, okay, like, hold it up. Like, so I can kind of get you in the background, that sort of thing. But he was all ready to go. Like, he wanted it. I probably had a dozen pictures, different angles. He's like, you could use this one for your website. And he's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
So Josh, we've reached the part of the podcast where we do this or that. And I really just have one thing for you. I was hoping you could expand on. What's it take to show a pig?
it takes a few screws loose to start off with.
So what is this pig? So our listeners, you know, audio format.
Yes. So on my Instagram profile, there is a picture of, I believe it was 2 years ago now. My brother-in-law and my in-laws have a show pig farm. So we raise breed stock, purebreds and crossbreds. So the pigs that you see at your local county fair that the 4-H kids have, or if you're lucky enough to go one of your state fairs, we actually show at national shows as well. So the pig that we showed, his name was, by his purchasers, he was named Bell Ringer. My in-law's last name is Bell. And he sold for a pretty penny. So he goes to a stud farm, much like racehorses have stud fees. Pigs do too. Yeah, yeah. They definitely live the life. It was pretty a unique experience. We've sold a couple into stud before, but that was a pretty special experience.
I was kind of curious what catches the judge's attention. Is it the lipstick or the fake eyelashes? I mean, how do you doll them up?
So apparently that filter Austin had on when we started recording.
Yes. Yeah. You got to shine them up. A lot of foundation. if anybody's been zoned out watching the Thanksgiving Day parade and managed to catch the dog show that's after.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So it's the same kind of idea. It's whether they fit the breed specifics the best. Mm-hmm. And their structure, so feet, legs, their skeleton, how their shoulders set to the rest of the body, that sort of thing, and whether they represent the breed that they are best. And in his particular instance, whether he's going to breed on his traits to make good little Hampshires is what he was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how much Bell Ringer weighed?
We never weighed him. Trying to think, he was probably in the he was probably 350, 375. He was a big boy by the time we showed him. Your pigs at your local county fair, most people don't think because of their size, they're only about 5 months old, between 5.5 to 6 months old. So, it's an all day, every day, you don't get to take off days kind of thing. So,
right. Yeah.
And when you have a farm full of them, there's definitely no off days. I tend to be the repair guy. I'm the guy out there with the welder. And,
oh yeah.
You know, hey, can you wire this up this way? Or our fans are working, sort of thing. So that's where I step in.
Cool.
Josh, another segment we're trying to bring into the podcast is like a shop safety, did you die kind of thing. So I'm just curious, what's like the biggest oh shit moment or closest to death that you've come in your workshop?
I haven't had too many close calls in my personal workshop, but because I work in a manufacturing environment, I have had a couple close calls. I primarily ran lathes. So I had an instance where the tailstock slipped out of a 15 to 20,000 pound shaft.
Wow.
It was about 26 inches in diameter, probably 20 foot long.
Oh wow.
And that'll definitely make you pay attention and stand up. Yeah.
I think that's probably gonna be one of the bigger oh shits we get for a little while.
Yeah, that was probably easily 12 years ago, and I still get reminded by it from guys in the shop. They're like, hey, remember that time?
Josh shit himself?
You almost died.
Yeah. But did you die?
Yeah.
All right, so we've reached the part of the podcast where I like to ask a question about the tools. And For this question, if you're going to be restarting your workshop from scratch, mm-hmm. what would be the first three tools that you're going to bring in?
So I would bring in a Bamboo Labs X1 Carbon.
Cool.
Because all the cool kids have them now. I don't have one, believe it or not, but I really want one. A good laptop, a good graphics card, and a lathe. I can do without a mill in my workshop, but a lathe I definitely use a lot more often.
What kind of lathe would you want?
Something with a quick change gearbox. I have a Logan 200 or 201. It was built in the 30s. It's great. Great lathe, but it has change gears, unfortunately.
Right. That's cool. All right. Well, we really appreciate you being on the podcast tonight. And if you would, please tell everybody where they can find you.
So you can find me on Instagram under Josh S. Vick is my handle. And if you have any questions or concerns, feel free to reach out.
Cool.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
If you'd like to join the folks over at Patreon, it's patreon.com/makingourwaypodcast. And our middle tier, we've got Tony Langer from Lingerworks, Susan DePlantis from Hearth and Garden Art, Stephanie Taddeo, Kyle with Footwork Woodworking, Dwayne McDowell, and Eric from Overall Makerworks.
All right, so since Dean's been taking this break, I heard a quote recently, and it was a guy talking about the ubiquitous of the internet and how now the internet is about consensus and it's not really about individualized thought. So you kind of put something out there and it's groupthink, and you're not able to really dive deep into a subject in your own way and kind of boil down the thought with no other people's input. And since Dean is now a hermit of Instagram, I've been wondering if you've advanced at all. And for example, like Albert Einstein, when he would go to try to think about a problem, he would sit on his porch by himself and go into deep thought. He wasn't curious what other people thought about it until he had fully worked it out.
Yeah.
You've been doing that?
I tell you, I spend a lot of time comparing myself to Einstein. I do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing I was thinking about the other day, so when I'm cutting these trees, instead of thinking about how can I post this, how can I capture this for an audience, I didn't do that. I really was focusing on the process, what worked best for what I was trying to do, where to stack the limbs, how to make the cuts, where was I going to haul this, where was I going to haul that, and I wasn't taking the breaks that it took. And so I kind of had like some real caveman moments in there and some very wandering thoughts that occurred that I don't know that I normally would have gotten to if what I was worried about was what's the best shot or what's the best way to capture this? What's the most dramatic way to put this out on my Instagram stories kind of thing? Because like right. we pulled a freaking tree down basically with this truck, and it would have been a great video. It absolutely would have been a great video. And you would have gotten a lot of back of like, oh, you shouldn't have done this. You should have gone backwards. You should have gone forward. You're using the wrong rope. You should have used this knot. And that's what you get when you get this groupthink, is you actually get almost a paralyzing distillation because you get all these different opinions that come in and you really don't know which ones are true, which ones have any support, which ones have any experience behind them, which ones are just some bullshit they saw somewhere else and they're presenting like it is their opinion or their truth.
And that's 90% right there.
What I had was I had a rope and a truck and a tree that had to come down.
Right.
And I had to figure out that situation. And then when I was the next day, I was cutting it with the chainsaw, you know, again, I could have, you know, hey, but I'm going to pose the question. What do you think I should make with this wood and try to get it? But I didn't have any of that. What I had was it was wet. It had rained. I've got the chainsaw. I'm trying to get the logs right and think about how they're going to bend. And then I could smell dinner cooking. And I was thinking about that, like how nice, not only like fasting from social media, but like how good it feels to work when you're hungry. Like you ever have, but these are the things I'm thinking about, where normally I would be checking to see how many people looked at my story. Did certain people comment? Have certain people seen it yet? What feedback? Where should I go next with this arc? I'm not. I was thinking about like, you know, it's after work. I haven't eaten since lunch. I'm hungry. I can smell the neighbors cooking. I can smell the food in my house. And like this, I know this great reward is going to be at the end of this hard work of this meal. And like, those were the things I was thinking about, these very, you know, almost, it's a little dramatic to say primal, but I was going down avenues that I don't normally go, because I normally go, it's almost like going into an apartment building that's full of people. That's where I'm normally going when I'm depositing my attention back to Instagram. But right. When I'm not going into that apartment, I'm going down the road less traveled, you know. I came to the fork in the road and I took the one less traveled. There's another quote for you. It was a different experience. And in that moment, I recognized that the work I was doing this week was a different experience than it would have been if I was capturing it for content.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience this week, and it was, we had the big storm roll through, and of course it knocked out our power. And when you lose power and you live in the country in your own well and septic, when you lose power, you lose everything. So you're right. In straight up stone age. Like you don't have water. You've got nothing. No running water. You can't flush a toilet, right? Or you can flush it once.
Once.
You better make sure you're good. And we actually lost power before the storm got bad, that's why I wasn't quite ready. And so the boys instantly, because they're, you know, products of this generation, they're like, without electronics or lights or like, they don't know what to do. Not really, you know, like they weren't 80s kids, right? Mm-hmm. Before there was, my parents used to just shove us outside and say, go play.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, Jamie's not gonna let them go out when it's 60 mile an hour winds. But I'm like, okay, I got to think of a game. Like, let's make up a game, and it was like, who can roll these balls past the dog without him catching them? Right. Cause he's, I'm like, it doesn't matter what the game is, just come up with a game. And I think that's part of the creative thing too, where like, if we used to do this game, sitting at the surf shop, and it would be like, it's very inappropriate, but it would be like, cause we were down the street from convention center, and all of the people would be walking past my surf shop, and we'd be slow and we'd be drinking out front in solo cups. And we would always play a game because we didn't have TV. There's nothing going on out there. We were just drinking and people watching. And it'd be like, all right, pick a number. And like each person would have to pick a number. And, or it's like one person, I don't remember how it was, but it was like, whoever walks past that point, you're like making out with that person, right? And so you're watching people, you're like, oh, please be number. Oh, start walking faster, right? And it's just some bullshit game, but we're fucking getting wasted.
These are games generated in your sterile environment.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
right.
And when I look back on them as like, they were so fun when you describe them to people, they sound so lame, but it was like, it was a team, you know, it was a bonding event, right? Because everybody's joking around, or you'd see like a crackhead while you're like, oh no.
I mean, that's a good point, Austin. You know, when Kristen and I were dating, we'd go to restaurants I'd drive up to Baton Rouge. She was still in law school. We'd go to restaurants, and that's where we came up with the tic-tac-toe game with the sugar packets. And so for those that don't know, I posted this game when Vincent and Ethan's podcast had like a create a game thing, but it's basically like a tic-tac-toe game that doesn't have boundaries. And that's because we were dating before cell phones had games on them.
Mm-hmm,
you weren't looking at your phone for a distraction. We were coming up with something. And so isn't that interesting? In the world of the internet, where all the facts are available and out there, sometimes the actual hub of creativity is right in front of you. You know, restricting yourself down to the world around you forces you to be more creative and to come up with solutions that are probably more palatable. I mean, how many people bitch because, oh yeah, if I had every tool, I could have done that too.
Yeah, right.
Well, they're going on YouTube and watching videos of people who have every tool and then getting mad that they can't replicate that process. Well, you should be focused on the process that you can replicate in the world that surrounds you.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. And that's what a lot of people, I think, do get in that. We're like, oh, well, I can't do that until I buy this tool. They're like, well, you could. There's a whole bunch of rednecks out there that get shit done with, you know, a lot less. So I think it's a cool, like when the power went out, it was like that scenario. And I like to come up with those games because like the kids, primarily like if you're around the group of kids at like a party or whatever, normally I'm the one, like I watch my kids. I don't let them just run wild. Like, and so we'd go to a party and I'm like, well, it looks like I'm staying with the kids because I'm not going to let my kids ruin somebody else's house. Like it's not happening, you know? And so they'd be like playing video game. I'm like, hey, let's play a game, you know? And I would just make up a game, like figure out like, oh, you got a ball, a beach ball over there. Let's play keep it up. You know, you can use hands and feet, but you can't do hand or hand. It has to be hand, foot, hand, you know, like alternate, make up some rules. Right. So like be creative. You know,
another one being off Instagram. So we went to a birthday party, a 1-year-old's birthday party at a bar. And I had much fun just critiquing and, you know, everything and everyone around me. And I was only doing that because I wasn't on my phone. Like in the lulls, I would have jumped right on my phone to see what my, well, quote unquote friends were doing, but where I'm actually at a party with someone who invited me to do something. And so I was able to look around and just, and it's always been something I've been good at is, and it sounds kind of shitty, but like the hypercritical critique, but, and I'm not, you know, this isn't to their face. We're just kind of like cracking up or whatever. And I'm making fun of cars in the parking lot and making fun of, you know, just whatever it is to get laughs out. And we actually watched our friend's kids. There was older kids there on the playground. And the mom is, I'm like, if you'd stop being a helicopter mom and, you know, let her meet some people. And then just watching those interactions, I never would have, I wouldn't watch other people's kids. I mean, I don't have a white van, interact like that, but I didn't have Instagram either. So that's the next best thing. Let me, you know, have these kids entertain me. And I definitely came away with that. Like I wouldn't have experienced this the same way if I was on my phone.
Yeah. When we've gone on vacations, like, and it's been quite a few years ago there too, before, like my daughters or the nieces, when we would go on big family group vacation road trips, typically, maybe texting was a thing at the time, but it wasn't all the rest of what's available. So we would draw names out of the hat to see which vehicle you're riding in. And then we had games along the way that I kind of coordinated. So it was, okay, anything from we're going to make up a story, like you're saying, as the car that drives by, and then, you know, take turns like that, or just observation games, or, you know, all those kind of things without being, you know, quiet, everybody with their nose in their phone or watching a movie or whatever, because that wasn't an option. So we could, you know, interact and have a fun, creative road trip.
Yeah, I think it'd be an interesting thing to try. I've seen where people will go like out to dinner and they put a basket in the middle and like everybody dump your phones in, you know? And I think that would make for a better time.
Oh yeah.
At least more engaged, you know?
Yeah. And, but then there, like we try to not be, especially if we're going to go out to dinner, we're not going to be on our phones. But we'll be talking about something and then we're like, oh, I need to look that up. Or like, what was the top 5 movie actors or whatever? You know what I mean? So then it's like you grab your phone because you're curious about the answer.
I always say, put the phones down. Put the phones down.
Yeah.
Gotta
stretch
these little muscles. We can stop.
Yeah, it's nice to have. And it's also a hindrance too.
Yeah, there's pluses and minuses to it all. For sure. Right. For sure.
Thanks for joining us today. If you like this episode, please give us a review and subscribe. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on Instagram at Making Our Way Podcast or on Patreon. You can find all of our latest individual content on Instagram or YouTube. I'm at High Caliber Craftsman. Dean is at Dean_Duplantis. And Christy is at Twisted Twine Woodworking. Lick it, stick it, see you later, bye.
And our first tier of patrons are Jacob from Griffin Makes, Jacob from Other Dog Designs, Keith Drennan from Blackthorn Concept, Justin from Bear Make It, Jeff Stein, a Weird Guy, Dave Bauer, Caitlin Landerno, Morley Kurt, Greg from Platte Valley Woodworks, Brendan McDonough from McDonough Designs, The Grant Alexander, Jen Griffin, The Black Sheep, Brian from Moonshine Leatherworks, The Makeshift Podcast, Maritime Knife Supply, Henry at HT1 Metalworks, Brad from Brad's Customs, Steve Delaney, a One Old School Pirate, Kelsey Watson, Dan Gallagher, Goofballs by Dan, Chris Powell, Full Steam Design, Spaghetti and Waffles, Rebecca Johansson, Ira Housewort, Ed Johns from ButtJoints.com, Dave Beckwith, Rob DeMarco, Dave at Atomic Airship Works, Earl the Third XYZ, Dana and Emmett at Rescue Room on Summit, Max at Camp Arrowhead, and Luke at LJB Makes. Thanks a bunch, folks.